We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hello, my name is Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 13th, 2016. I have 4 years, 4 months, and 28 days of sobriety. I am now a school teacher. I had been a bartender for the past 20 years before becoming a school teacher, and I was born and raised in Long Beach, California. I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1985. My mom was an alcoholic, and she was admitted to Long Beach Memorial Hospital for their drug and alcohol program, and she did the program, and after she came out of the program, she became a drug and alcohol counselor. And during that time, I went to the Family Week, and it was the first time that I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been using drugs and drinking my whole high school and junior high time period. I originally started drinking around age 13. The very first substance I ever tried was pot and marijuana. I smoked a joint in sixth grade. I traded a handful of sunflower seeds to a neighbor for some homegrown, and I remember going to baseball practice being stoned. I really didn't get addicted, or really didn't notice any extreme drinking problems early on in my youth. But as I got into high school, it became more and more a part of my life and identity. I am a person that has, I've never been specifically diagnosed with dyslexia, but I have had a reading comprehension issue my whole entire life. I was in remedial English courses and really struggled reading out loud. And I was kind of a shy kid. And once I started drinking, I started to be kind of that clown in the class. And I started to get a reputation for being that person that could cause a little mischief. And I started appreciating that identity. And it became more and more who I was. I started to use cocaine. Started to sell drugs in high school. I was a surfer kid. I remember when I first got into junior high, my mom wrote me a note for being sick. And I took that note and I ripped it up and I wrote my own note and I signed it with her signature. So I wrote my own notes all the way through junior high and high school. So whenever I felt like I wanted to leave school, I would just write a note and I would go surf or do my things. And as I continued on with my schooling, I barely graduated high school. I graduated with a 1.86 GPA. I like to say this because I teach college now and I teach English. And so I'll get to that in a moment. But being a person that barely graduated high school and struggled with reading and writing, it was being an English teacher now is unbelievable to me, and it wouldn't be for if it wasn't for AA and Alcoholics Anonymous for me to have gotten here. When I was in just graduated high school, I started to surf a lot, and I was working at McDonnell Douglas as a sheet metal fabricator, and I changed my work schedule. During the summertime, I would work the night shift and surf. Excuse me, that was the right way around. During the winter, I would work the night shift so I could surf in the morning, and during the summer, I would work the day shift so I could surf the glass off. And I really wasn't drinking too much back then, or I didn't think I was. I did a lot of partying, but it was partying. It was fun. It was exciting. It was, you know, in my 20s and having a good time for the most part. One thing happened to me in 1990, or actually a little bit before that. I got a my girlfriend pregnant, and I had a son at the age of 21. My son was born in 1990, and that's when my drinking changed a little bit. I started to get violent. I started to get in fights at the bars, and I started to act out with the drinking, and it was no longer that fun experience that it was. It started to turn for me. And so during that time with the young father and dealing with that stuff, I got sober with the help of my parents, because at that time I got kicked out of the house and I got kicked out of my roommate's place, and I was living in my car for a little bit. And the way to get back in my mom's house was for me to get sober. And so I got sober, and I was sober for 4 years during my 1992 to 1996. I have to say this right now. That time, when I look back at that time today, I see that as every moment of every moment of sobriety that I've had in my life has been more meaningful than any other time in my life. Drinking, drugging, being sober has changed a lot for me, and being in the program. During that time, in the early 90s, when I was first sober as a young father, I was very isolated at the time. I had to seek out outside help. The psychologist, I was going to that. I had severe anxiety attacks during this time. And I spent that 4 years going to not too many meetings, but I would go to meetings, and I did do the steps. And I went to an outpatient program as well through my work insurance. But what happened for me at the end there is I didn't have a strong foundation in the program, and I started to feel very alone at that time. And I didn't really have any friends to share my sobriety with or my experience at the time. Most of my friends were punk rockers and drug addicts and partying. I was driving them around all the time to the pool halls and the shows and stuff like that. And I just one day decided to, it was one day, it took me about 6 months before I actually picked up a drink. But then I picked up a drink, and I was on it again, and did a pretty fair amount of drinking. I lost my job, or got laid off from McDonnell Douglas and Boeing, and I was jumping around at little jobs here and there, and I was going to a bar a lot, and two of the bartenders were women, and they were both pregnant at the time, and they thought it'd be fun for me to get behind the bar and wash the dishes for them to ease their back pain. And what happened when I was behind the bar, I started to enjoy myself, and they would pay me in drinks, and I would drink behind the bar. And the next thing you know, I was offered the 6 a.m. bartender shift. And I started to bartend the 6 a.m. shift. That morning shift is at bars like that, it can be quite interesting, to say the least. And I did that for a little while, and I was off and running again. And during that time, it was there was a lot of drugs during that time, a lot of drinking, and I came to a point where I was losing a lot of things in my life. I was having difficulty with my son's mom, and we went to court, and she wanted to take my son away from me, to have my son be adopted by his new stepdad. And with the help of my mom, I fought that in a court case. And during that time of the court case, I was working as a second job in San Pedro in a hospital there. I was an admitting clerk. And there was a woman there who was paralegal, and I was writing my deposition or my story, and I have difficulty writing, and I could spell and all that stuff like that. And she looked at what I was writing, and she helped me write my side of the story, you know, just the facts. And during that process, I realized that this is something that I might want to pursue. I might want to pursue education. When she was helping me out during that time, I was still drinking at that moment. But what happened for me is I was playing music and in the bars, and I was singing on dirty microphones, and I got exposed to tuberculosis. And so I had to, I went to the doctors, and the doctors told me that I had to take this medicine, and they recommended that I don't drink during that time. And so with the court case happening, with all this stuff going on, I decided to once again give sobriety a chance. And I got sober in 2001. I was in my early 30s at the time. And I decided at that moment that if I was going to be sober, that I was miserable at the job, and I had gone through the court case. I had got my day in court. I was going to continue to be part-time parent for my son during this time, and she couldn't take him away from me, which was very important for my family. And I said to myself after I wrote that letter, after I got through that experience with her, that I wanted to go back to college, and I wanted to be an English teacher. And I know it sounded crazy at the time, but I figured if I could become an English teacher, there would be nothing in this world that I couldn't do. And so I started that process in 2005. I went back to school, and I started to take classes at the City College over here in Long Beach. And I got through it, and then I had to wait a little while to go to the four-year school, Cal State Long Beach, and I did that. But after 2 years of sobriety, the whole time that I was sober that time around, I just, in my gut, in the back of my head, there was this thing that always told me that I was going to go back out, and I did do the steps again. I did have a sponsor. I did go to meetings. I was pretty good at it. But once again, I didn't work a strong program, and life was starting to get a little bit good. And I started to achieve at school, and I was doing okay. And I decided to go back out again. And I went out for 15 years. During that time, my alcoholism increased significantly. I actually counted the days where I did not drink during that time. I stopped drinking for Lent 1 year to see if I could do it when I ran a marathon that year. I did finish college with still drinking, but I didn't. It was tough. I was a bartender in Pechanga. I was living with my dad out in Temecula half the week. And the other half of the week, I had a room that I was renting in Long Beach where my son was staying at. And a friend of mine who has been sober to this day for over 20 years, he was a heroin addict, and we were good friends. And he let me rent the room there, even when I was drinking for some time. Then as I was finishing up my master's degree, my alcoholism was exploding. My mom called me in 2014 when I was working at the bar during the night, and she told me that she had been diagnosed with stage 4 metastasizing metastatic, whatever pronounce it, breast cancer. And she was given a 10% chance to make it through that year. And this was on April 26th, 2014. And it was a shock. My mom is the most influential person in my life, besides my son. But the person who influenced me the most was my mom. And my mom had no longer been sober. She was also drinking, but she had her alcoholism in control at that point. But we were drinking buddies. You know, my mom and I, my mom used to come to the bars where I worked at, and she would drink with me. But she's always the person that, even though we drank together, she was concerned for me. She saw how I was drinking, and I couldn't even hide. I couldn't hide it from her. And so, in 2015, I actually got a master's degree. I remember the day before I was going to take my exam, I almost called the office to postpone it because I was so fucked up. I was drinking. My blood pressure was spiking. I was in a lot of pain. I was having anxiety. All these things happening because of my drinking. And I did it. I went to the exam. I was shaking. I was hungover. I had a problem with the question they asked me, and it was a horrible experience, but I made it through it. And as I came out of that, I still was drinking. I still didn't care. I worked a 6 a.m. shift, and I watched friends of mine turn yellow. I watched people die of cirrhosis and liver cancer. I looked at the wall of some of the bartenders that were there before me that were in their early 40s, and the picture on the wall was 20 years old. And I looked at them today, and I saw the effects of alcohol and what it does to real alcoholics. And I saw it in their faces, and I watched them die. And I was on that pathway. I mean, I couldn't wait to get up in the morning to ride my bike to the bar, to open it up and to crack open whatever the hell I wanted to crack open. And I lived that way. And for a while there, and I knew no other way at that moment. And so as my health started to deteriorate, I was taking high blood pressure medicine, and I ran out of my prescription, and the doctors wouldn't refill it. And so I thought that I can go to a minute clinic, a CVS, and have a nurse practitioner write me a script. And so I went there, and she tested my blood pressure, and she got up and panicked and called the paramedics. And the paramedics came in, and she's like, "Don't panic." And I'm like, "What do you mean, don't panic?" And she said, "You know, just relax." And so they came in, put an EKG on me, and I blew a blood pressure of, what was it, 226 over 126. And they thought that, I asked the paramedic, I go, "Am I dying right? Am I having a heart attack right now?" He's like, "Sir, we can't tell you that. We're going to take you to the hospital." And I go, I didn't have insurance at the time, and I didn't want to take a $3,000 limousine ride to the emergency room. So I told them that I would just go ahead and drive myself. And during that time, I was going to the hospital. I called my mom, and she said, "Well, why don't you come over here first?" And I went over there, and I drank a bottle of wine, and I pounded some Valiums that she had for her cancer meds. And my blood pressure went down, and I thought to myself, I just need to drink more. I can't go that long without it. Otherwise my blood pressure would go up. And that's the way I thought at that moment in time. So fast forward a little bit, my mom's cancer got worse, and I decided to move in to help my mom with her situation. And I moved in, and within a month, my mom had kicked me out of the house because she couldn't stand the way I smelt. The booze was emitting through my pores, and everywhere I went, I was reeking of alcohol. I could not escape that smell, and it was, you can call it vanity, but that idea of me smelling like booze really started to get to me. You know, I'm a verging on a 50-year-old man. I was like 48 at the time, I think, 40, something like that. And when my mom threw me out, it was an eye-opener for me, and I did not stop drinking then. I kept on going for another about a year and a half. I found a crappy little apartment on 4th Street in Long Beach above a bar. Above a bar I would end up working at. And at the end of my drinking, I remember I had a futon that a friend at the bar, another alcoholic, gave me to sleep on. And I had an empty apartment and a futon with had a refrigerator. And I remember drinking myself to death up in that apartment, unable to walk downstairs to go sit in the bar where I could basically drink for free. I would just lay on the floor. And I remember, this is right before I decided to get sober, I would lay on the floor with a towel wrapped around me with booze, and I would listen to the people below I would be on above them, obviously. So I would listen to the people below clinking bottles and laughing and having a good time. And across the alleyway was a place called the Round Table. It's a sober, it's a meeting hall. And on Sundays, they would the last Sunday of the month, they would celebrate birthdays, but they had three or four meetings a day. And as I'm laying on the floor listening to the people clap and cheer and below me drinking and have a good time, I would hear people clap, and I would hear people say, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I could hear them clap after each share. And I had a decision to make. I had a decision to make because I could not see myself living this way anymore. I couldn't drink anymore. I couldn't drink any less. I was a shell of a person. I could not. Life was getting in the way of my drinking, and my body was shutting down. And I knew about the program, obviously. I've been sober twice before for some time. And my ego just kept me from getting in there, getting into the meeting rooms. And there was a bartender that I worked with that I thought was a much more, much worse off alcoholic than I was, because he was a binge drinker and I was a marathon drinker. I drank slow and steady, and I just kept it in my system as much as I could. And he got a week of sobriety, and that little nugget went into my brain, and I thought that if he could do it, maybe I could do it. And so one morning he was going down to the 7 a.m. meeting at the local Marina Pacifica hall, and asked if I wanted to go, and I said yeah. So he picked me up, and he was driving me down there, and I asked him to stop at the bar, and I took four shots of vodka before I went to that meeting. And I went to that meeting, and I made it through it. He wanted to go get coffee afterwards. I couldn't drink coffee. I was shaking too bad, so I had to go back to the bar. But the next 5 days, I went to that meeting at 7 a.m. I drank every morning before I went to that meeting, and I sat there, and I was welcomed by my friends. You know, I'm from Long Beach. This is a Long Beach meeting hall. I grew up in the bars. I knew half these people from being sober before. I knew them from the bars, you know, and nobody gave me attitude. They smiled and they welcomed me. And during this time, believe it or not, aside from being a bartender, I had a friend of mine from college who was a teacher at a local community college, and she also ran the tutoring department there, and I was struggling at the time, and she asked me if I wouldn't mind tutoring over there, and I did that. I did that while I was drinking, and I can only imagine how, and it's embarrassing for me to think about, but how these students, I would tutor individual students sitting at the same table, and how much I must have just reeked like alcohol, because I would drink in the parking lot there. I would pour vodka down Gatorade bottles and bottles of vitamin bottles. I remember going into the bathrooms and trying to crack open that half pint or pint. And it was the hardest thing for me to do. I mean, cough through it. Like anybody's actually listening. But, I would pour those, pour vodka down those bottles and drink it at work. And a friend of mine got a full-time teacher, not full-time, but I got a teaching position at the college. And she was younger than me. And I just applied for it. I applied for a teaching position. And I got it. And the reason why I went into that meeting, those meetings, and the reason why I was trying to get sober is because I got that teaching job, and I knew that there was no way in hell that I could walk into a classroom and teach if I was still drinking. There was no way. I would be fired very shortly afterwards. And so right before I started that first semester of teaching, I went to the MP, and I started to go to the round table, and I started to go to the meetings, and after 5 days of detoxing, I walked into a classroom. I walked into a classroom. Never before took a class on teaching. I took English courses. I took creative writing courses. I never took classes about how to teach a class. So I did have a syllabus. I had taken classes, so I know what teachers do, but I never knew what it would be like to walk into a classroom. So I walked into a classroom, and as I'm about ready to say, my name's Jeff, and I almost going to say alcoholic, but I didn't. I looked, and there was a girlfriend of mine that I went to school with, and she was a hairstylist, and she was in the program. And I knew that she was in the program. And so this is 5 minutes before class starts. And I asked her, I said, Renee, would you step outside with me? And she came outside of the classroom. And I go, are you still sober? And she's like, yeah. I go, I got 5 days. I go, I'm shaking and I'm baking and I'm sweating. And she's like, and she looked at me and she said, Jeff, don't worry about it. We'll get you through this semester. That's a God shot if there ever was one, because of that, because of her, and because I started to work this program, I was able to teach a class. And here is a guy who graduated high school with a 1.86 GPA, a person who struggles with reading and writing and talking. I didn't know that if you have dyslexia, mumbling or inability to talk clearly is another part of the disease or whatever it is. Like I said before, I've never specifically been diagnosed, although it runs in my family. But I taught that class, and I did it. I knew that being sober before that it was kind of a fog for me, being in the fog when I first got sober and teaching the class. I mean, I can't tell you what I said or how I did it, but I did do it. But it took me a while to get a sponsor. I knew that I needed some time before I picked a sponsor. And so I waited 11 months of sobriety before I picked a sponsor. This is my story this time around. I knew that just giving myself some time between the bottle and some physical sobriety before I could actually sit down and work the steps again. And the reason why this time it feels different to me is because the first time I got sober was because of anger. The second time was just basically loneliness. This time was that spiritual malady that we talked about. I didn't care if I lived or died before I came in to the rooms of AA again. And what I have learned from this program, walking through the steps with my sponsor doing them honestly, working through step nine, making my amends, my living amends to my mom, was the reason that I am still sober today, for the most part. In remember sitting down with my mom, you know, making my amends list was not as long as it was before this time around, but I had my girlfriend and my son and my mom on that list, you know, amongst other things. But when I sat down to do my amends to my mom, I remember, you know, she's a drug and alcohol counselor, had been in her lifetime, and I know that she knew what amends are and how they're supposed to work. But I remember talking to her and just sweating so hard before I could actually say I'm sorry either. And not only say I'm sorry, but to know that saying sorry was the beginning of the action that I needed to take for the true living amends for her. And this was about 2 years into her cancer diagnosis, maybe three. She survived cancer, stage four metastatic cancer, for 6 years. She battled it for almost 6 years. She passed on January 20th of 2020. So we were almost at the precipice of her year anniversary of her death, and a couple of days from now. But that I knew that once I said sorry to her in such a way that that it was the beginning of my living amends, and which is such an important part of my sobriety today. Because when I had that spiritual malady and that understanding of where I was at, I realize now when I look back how fragile my self-esteem was. Even though I thought I was living some kind of bar star lifestyle, it was really a shell of an existence. But working the steps with my sponsor and doing those amends started to taking that contrary action, started something inside of me where I started to build that self-esteem. This is reminding me of a time where I can demonstrate on what AA has done for me. My mom and I, as close as we were, we battled. We battled our whole lives. I fought with my mom all the time. And I remember after making those amends, taking her back and forth to the hospital. And one time we were coming back from the hospital, and it wasn't a very good day for her. And we started to argue. And it got pretty bad, and she said to me that I'm the worst son that she's ever. I'm not one of the worst sons in the world, or something to that effect. And it hit me hard, and I remember picking up the phone and calling my aunt and calling my cousin and talking to my sponsor and anybody who'd listen to me. I was like, "Am I a bad son? Am I bad?" And I kept on asking all these people about that, and. Because I was devastated about that, because basically it was I hadn't done anything to build on my self-esteem at that point in time. I mean, I was just sober for a little bit, and so fast forward another year from there, my mom and I had a very similar fight. And she said the same thing again to me. And she said, "You know, you're a horrible son." And I knew that I was doing the best that I could. I had been sober for about 3 years at the time, and I had worked the steps. I got a sponsee. I walked him through the steps. I go to meetings consistently. share my experience straight and hope with anybody who's reaching out for help. I drive guys from the local NFL facility to meetings. So I do all that stuff at the program that we are responsible for doing in the program. And when my mom said that again to me this time, I said, "Mom, go ahead and tell anybody who will listen," basically, because I knew between me and God that I had worked those steps. I am present, and I try my best to be a good. I was trying my best to be a good son to her, and so that was. It took me a moment to realize what I just said to her when I walked away, and I got back in my car and drove home and talked to my sponsor and blah, blah, blah. The next thing I realized is that I truly believe that I was not a scumbag. And that was an important discovery for myself, because I had felt like a scumbag for a long time. Not worthy of anything in life. I obviously struggle with the imposter syndrome that many of us do. As a teacher, I've been teaching going on my fifth year this next semester of teaching. I went back to school and because it's hard to get a full-time teaching job in a junior college. Being an instructor at junior colleges, so I decided to go back to school and get my single subject credential so I could become a secondary educator. And I'm going to be student teaching in the spring semester here. These are all things that I would not be able to do if I didn't stop picking up a drink. I still suffer from that imposter syndrome, but I know that if I'm present and doing my best, that's all I can do. I have to turn it over to my higher power. And just as I keep on coming back to my mom here, because I'm sitting in the house that she has left to the family, and I'm taking care of that house for her. Right before she passed, the last month, it was really difficult. I couldn't afford a full-time caregiver. I was on a break between school. We have 3 weeks off in the fall semester and the spring semester, and the classes were coming up, and my mom was really ill. And doing things as a son you don't ever want to do for a parent, taking her to the bathroom, changing her, cleaning her. And one afternoon I was pulling her up off the pot, and she wasn't trusting my strength to hold her up, and she was grabbing for the wall, and she made it real difficult for me to maintain my balance. And I forcefully pulled her away from her grip on the wall and put her down in her walker, and I was rolling her back to the bed, and she looked at me, and I'll never forget this. It's a horrible thing to think about, but she said under her clenched teeth, as this would be probably about 2 weeks before she expired, she said, "You are so mean," in her clenched teeth. And this is me with 3 years of sobriety, with the desire to make my living amends. And I was devastated by that comment she made to me. And I said to my mother, "Mom, I'm just trying to help you. I'm just trying to, you need to trust me here." And I put her back in bed. And I remember getting to my knees in the other room. And I was praying to God and just saying, this is not what I wanted to do for my mom. I wanted to be that cosmic guru that was going to get her to transition to the next thing in the afterlife with this peaceful, wonderful transition. And it didn't happen. you know. And during that prayer, as I was on my knees, it came to me that I'm not in control. And even though I had this responsibility coming up with school, where I would have to leave her for 8 hours at a time, I was going to have to find somebody to be a caregiver for her. I knew that things were going to work out, not on my time, but on the right time. And I just needed to get in line with that. And this is taking me to another digression here, but I had befriended a Catholic priest. One of his uncle used to drink at my bar, and he came into my bar a couple of years prior, and I introduced, I'll just say his name, Father Lawrence, to my mom, and they became good friends. And this is a while back. I used to drink in the rectory with them, and I thought that was kind of funny for me, being a bartender and kind of a low life, to be in a rectory with a priest drinking as a non-religious person. But Father Lawrence was a friend of my mom, and I called him in Ireland that day after that experience, that thing happened with my mom. And I said to him, I said, Father Lawrence, I go, you know, this is what happened. I manhandled my mom at a moment. And I feel terrible. And he said to me, Jeff, you have to realize that you're not Superman. You're not, you're a human being. You're going to make mistakes. And you just listened to me, and you know, he said you have to embrace that, and these little things, reaching out, calling somebody. You know, Father Lawrence is not in the program, but he is a priest, and it does talk about that in our book, that we can reach out to clergy if not. And I reached out to him, reached out to my sponsor, and I discussed these things, and it helped me process that, process what had happened, and realize that I'm only a human being. Even in sobriety, I can make mistakes. We're not saints. You know, so we have to. This is a program that on page 275 of the big book, towards the end of the chapter of the Keys to the Kingdom, it talks about how we as alcoholics have to always take one foot and put it in front of the other. We always have to work on ourselves, and we always are going to be doing that. And so that was a learning experience for me. I had another 2 weeks with my mom. During that time, I ended up being able to get a hold of a caregiver that I could possibly afford. And I wouldn't know how I was going to do it or how long it was going to last, but I put it on my credit card or whatever it was going to be. And she came in on a Sunday or Saturday afternoon, and I watched her take her, my mom, off the pot, and I watched her clean my mom up, and I learned what these people do for individuals that are suffering end of life diseases and whatnot. And so I at least the last 2 days of my mom's life, I was able to be everything that I wanted to be for her during that time. The caregiver came to me. This is part of the home health care that we had. They stopped in once a day and whatnot, and all the conversations I had with her, the home health care giver said, I have a son, Jeff. She said, I hope that my son is as attentive as you are, as I've witnessed you be with your mom. And even though her saying that to me, even though she's a caregiver, I still didn't believe her. You know, my alcoholism still rings in my brain, and I still felt, you know, like, oh my God, I'm a horrible person for treating my mom bad that way. But anyways, I was able to be myself regardless of the imperfections. I guess that would be what I'm saying. I feel like I'm a little bit starting to ramble here towards the end of this, but being sober, going through that with my mom, if I had been picking up at that time, I would have stolen the last moments of my mom's life as far as having her worry about what is going to happen to her house or what's going to happen to the family. The last thing my mom ever said to me, or actually the last thing she ever texted me, was the last thing that I got was on, she sent me a text message and it said, thanks. And I will always have that text message. I will always have the understanding that, you know, that I was sober during that time. Even though I wasn't perfect and it was difficult, I tried my best. I reached out for help. I used the tools that I learned from this program to make me a better individual, a better son to her, to course correct in the midst of the most intense moment of my life. And and when she passed, it was on a Monday. It was Monday. Around 7 o'clock at night, I had taken a jog because my son and my niece, we were in the room that day having a conversation, and a nurse came in and she shoved an oxygen mask in my mom's face, and there was a noise in the room. I knew my mom, we had nice music playing for her, and I knew that my mom wouldn't like that noise coming in there, and I was talking to the nurse and like, why'd you do that? And he said it was for her comfort. And I kind of lost it for a little bit. And my son said, hey, Dad, why don't you go take a little break? So I went and took a run. I got some pizza and I came back, walked in. I said to my mom, hey, Mom, I'm here. We're all here, whole family. And my brother was there, my niece and my son. So all the immediate family was around her. And I said, you can go if you want. We're going to go grab some pie and we're going to watch a movie. We'll be right back. And during the time I was eating pizza, I got up and something called me. I was going to grab another slice of pizza. And I realized that I had never kissed my mom on the forehead. And I just immediately walked into her bedroom. I kissed her on the forehead and I stood by her and I said, it's been an honor. And I walked out of that room, and I called the nurse up, and I said, you know, what's going on here? And she said, well, I go, how much longer she got? Because the next day I started school, and the nurse said, well, this happens and this happens during this time, and people that are passing, they'd like to have the light on. So I went into the room and turned the light on, and my son bent down to check on my mom, and said she wasn't breathing, and she had passed. And it wasn't, I keep on saying it wasn't for AA, but I'm so thankful that I was able to give my mom a kiss on her forehead and tell her it's been an honor. Since then I haven't had to pick up a drink. You know, that's the last thing that I need to think about right now, because you know, I think back to my drinking career and being in the bar industry and seeing all the ruckus and hoopla that happens around a bar, the times that you would have at 6 in the morning when other bartenders had been up all night and they knew that I was working at the bar. They knew what was in store for them, and the shenanigans that we would get into and all the stuff that would happen during that time. All the times were, it might've felt fun. What I realized today is that every moment of pain, every moment of discomfort, every moment of insecurity, every moment of experience that I've had in the last 4 years, being sober has been more meaningful than any day that I picked up a drink and thought I was having a great time. So I am a full-blown member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this program. I love the relationships that I built in here. I'm learning how to be a man, a little late to the game, but I'm learning how to be a good father to my son, a good friend, a good brother, a good uncle. And as my dad, I shared this earlier, as my dad is dealing with pancreatic cancer today and is in a similar situation that my mom was, I pick up the phone, I call my dad every day. I visit him. I ask what I can do for him, just like I would ask any person who would come to me and help in with alcoholism or in the program. And I am there for him. And I think that I don't really know how much more I gotta say thank you to this program, but knowing that, I'll just end with this. I'll just say that this program has done one thing for me, and that is the ability to occasionally, or actually the ability to better be in the moment and being present than I've ever been before in my life. So AA has allowed me to be in the moment. And that's all we have. And I think that's a good place to stop for me.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm emotional from hearing you share about the last days with your mom. So I'm just kind of gathering my thoughts, but I appreciate you sharing. My mother was 52 when she died of this disease, and you're 52.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a reminder of how amazing this program is, and probably how proud your mother is of you. I have a mother of three. You have a son. I absolutely want my children to live a life of sobriety, because of all the things that you've explained over the last hour or so about what it's brought to your life. So I can't speak for your mother, but I can speak for mothers in general. And I imagine she's extremely proud of your sobriety.
Yeah, I thank you for saying that. I always, you know, at this, now I talked to my sponsor before I jumped on this, this podcast, and he was saying, you know, like lots of people start from the beginning and move forward. But I really wanted to concentrate on my mom because of how important that relationship was to me in my life. And I just want to, you know, when I was making my amends, I also didn't really talk about the amends that I had to make to my son. But making amends to my mom to say I'm sorry was difficult enough as it was. But looking, because you mentioned children, looking my son in the eye at breakfast when I was asking him, and this is what I had to ask him, and this is quite embarrassing for me to say. I said, did you feel like you had a father growing up? You know, And I know the reason why. So I was present in his life. I was his, you know, assistant baseball coach and that kind of stuff like that. But the drink was always in the back of my mind when he was growing up. You know, I just need to maintain enough until he goes to sleep, and then I can start my drinking. You know, just maintain this weekend, drop him off on a Sunday, you know, pick him up on a Friday, maintain some sense of not sobriety, but just maintain my alcoholism during that time when he was younger. But I got sober when my son was 1 year old, or two, one and a half, 2 years old, the first time. Those next 4 years were the most enduring moments that I will ever have with my son. The second time around when I got sober, those 2 years, that was a court case. The court case was to keep my son in my life because his mom wanted to take him out of my life. I fought for him. My mom had to sit my son down because my son asked my mom to be put up for adoption because his mother and his stepfather said I would never be able to pay the back child support that I owed to his mother, and it would be easier for me to give him up for adoption. My mom got him in the car and started to drive him to his mom's house and said, "You don't want this family's last name? You can go." And my son was devastated by my mom's reaction, but she fought for me. You know, my mom paid my rent when I was going to going through that court case. And she was a second mother to my son. And the family thing is so important for me now, realizing that my whole life when I was drinking, I didn't understand what it means to be a good citizen. You know, today, that's all I want to be, you know, as a good citizen. I want to be a high school, middle school teacher so I can inspire students to live a good life, to live a clean life, you know, to be there for their family and their community. AA has given me a community to be part of, to seek out spirituality. I'm a Catholic groupie. I go to a Catholic church. I didn't know that they had services at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And when I started working my program, I realized that, you know, I could go to church. You know, I went to church, and that Catholic priest asked me one time, he's like, "Why do you go to church?" And I go, "Well, I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm searching for that higher power. I'm searching for the power greater than myself. I'm searching for spirituality. I want to have that part. I need to build on that part of my life." And that father, that priest, came to me about a year and a half ago and asked me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He asked me about what I got out of this because he was having difficulties with his own drinking. Do I look less? Do I look upon him any less? Hell no. You know, this program is a gift. You know, do I ever think about drinking? And to tell you the truth, I mean, I broke my drinker. I tried to maintain drinking, but it just doesn't work for me anymore. It just causes pain, causes physical, mental, and spiritual pain every time that I drink, or when I was drinking at the end there. And man, you know, for that person that is suffering with alcoholism today and you can't stop, man, that's a rough place to be in. But like I said before, you know, working through those moments of uncomfortableness, you know, and getting on the other side of it, you know, my mom died. I didn't pick up a drink. It'll be a year on the 20th of this month, you know, and I've kept this house clean, for my son and my niece, you know, when it comes their time to take over this house. And so, it's in family and friendship. You know, your family, you know, if you burn your bridges with your family, AA is a family. You know, I know that I could pick up and go anywhere in the United States and find an AA meeting. Now, with Zoom, we can find meetings all over the world.
That's
our
right.
Fingertips. You could be in your chonies and be on a meeting and talk to somebody that can share your story. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's wonderful.
Thank you, COVID.
True. I wouldn't be talking to you if it wasn't for COVID. You know, and I spent the whole day worrying about being too boring because I didn't want my message to be about the drinking, because, you know, there was a lot of, because, you know, I love alcoholics, you know, real alcoholics. You know, I'll share this last thing and I'll shut up. There was a time this kid came into my bar at 6 a.m. And you always know when a real alcoholic comes into the bar if you haven't met him before. And because you can see it, I know it. You know, I know because I've gone into the liquor store. It's, you know, right when it opens up and, oh, hey, ha-ha, I'm a little hungover, a little hair of the dog, you know, and you're knowing that, you know, you're trying to pull it off, that you're not embarrassed, you're not shaking, you're not, you know, you don't really feel dirty. Of course, I felt dirty, you know, but this guy came in my bar and he started drinking. He was turning up a little bit, and I saw him make a phone call. He was talking to his wife or girlfriend about something, and I knew he had relapsed, you know. And after I left that shift, I went home and I cleaned up, and I went to the meeting hall, which was right across the, I was still living above the bar at the time, and I was going to the round table, and I walked in there, and the kid was in the meeting. He was in, the guy that I served booze to that morning was in the meeting. He had a tall can in his back pocket, and he had a half pint of Jack in his coat pocket. And I was sitting right behind him, and he turned around. He said, "You look familiar." I said, "Yeah, I was your bartender this morning." And he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." I go, "Look, man, it's all good. You know, keep coming back. No reason to shear our wounded, man. You know, that's me. That person is me." And when I walked walked back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was open hands and smiles. And if there would have been somebody that would have frowned on me for drinking those first 5 days, you know, I would not be alive today. You know, my drinking was taking me down that path. I have one of those pills called, I keep it, I'll shake it right here if you can hear it. These are pills that I keep, and these are those nitroglycerin pills that you take for when you're having a heart attack. Well, I have those. I was taking those behind the bar when I was working. One time I took two of those because I didn't know if you took two at one time, you can possibly, if you take too many of those, you can die. I took two one time and I almost fainted outside of the bar, and I walked back into the bar, and what did I do? I took a shot of Fernet, you know, and it kept on going. And so this is an insidious disease. I like to say, AA is a simple program for a complex issue for complicated people. Me and the complex, because I'm English major complex, there's no one solution. Complicated means that you can find, it's difficult, but you can find the solution. So you can find your pathway in this program, but our disease is complex, and so it's insidious, cunning, baffling, and powerful, right? But it is a simple program, and don't pick up, no matter what. Get that head on a pillow sober. Wake up the next day, and you got a chance to start anew.
That is such a great place to end, and I can't, because I feel like there's a little bit of an elephant in the room. And that's your mom going back out and drinking again.
Mm.
And I don't know that this can stay in your share, if it's going to be edited out, but I'm feel like it's a little bit of a contradiction when we talk about the rooms and recovery and your mom. So I don't want to hear her story, but is there anything you want to talk about in terms of that to help the listener understand? If I went back out drinking, I would have no relationship with my son at all. Mm. It was very hard for me to have a relationship with my mom when she was drinking or using. She wasn't much of a drinker. So I'm baffled by your blood pressure and her telling you to come over and giving you alcohol. Like, I'm just baffled by this piece of the story.
Well, let's go there. This might take
no pressure.
I have no problem answering this question, because I can see where that would be a place of clarification. My mom maintained herself for a long time. Successful, a person, a flawed person, right? I mean, we're all, no one's perfect. And Was she an alcoholic, a real alcoholic? I would have to say that most likely. I mean, I'm a son, so my perception is a little bit clouded about this, but I would have to say most likely she was. When we got good news about the cancer, when I was still drinking, we went to the bar and drank. When we got bad news, we went home and drank. And that time when I came and lived with her, when she kicked me out, it was a competition to see how, we would buy a six pack of wine, and I would, she would try to stay with me, and she would drink a lot, and even with her drinking a lot, she still had to kick me out because of the extreme amount of drinking that I was doing. She was a red wine drinker. She drank. She ended up, dealing with her cancer, dealing with her terminal diagnosis. She fought a brave fight, and there was a point. There was a point when I got sober and she was still drinking. You might have to edit this out, but she would ask me to, come across town and buy her a bottle of waters and pick up booze for her, and I would. And the rationalization for me at that time was, she's going out. She's the terminal cancer, she wasn't a sloppy drunk like that. Although, she stopped drinking at the end. What happened was, about 2 years before she died, she slipped and fell, and shattered her hand and had to have surgery on it. And what had happened was, I put together the pieces, and she had gone to the bar with some friends after trivia. A pub quiz, and they went out to a bar afterwards and came home. It was trash day, and she was going to take the trash out, and she tripped and fell because she took her meds and had drank, and so she was drunk, and she fell and shattered her hand. And I had that talk with her. I said, "Mommy, look," and this is what I said to her, and this is just my honest response. I said, "Mom," I go, "you're drunk. You were drunk when that happened." And I said to her, "I'm not judging you. I'm not judging you, Mom. You could do what you want, but don't lie to me about what had happened, she kept on drinking. Drank her red wine. She had a tremendous amount of young friends, and they would go out and take her out to play pub quiz, and that was the way she wanted to live her life. And maybe that's something that, in fact, I am seeking outside help, and I am discussing my relationship with my mom. And so maybe that's something that I need to delve into, because my grandfather, her dad, he died of this disease. He died of alcoholism, and it runs in my family. And so my mom wasn't drinking at the end of her life. But the last, I'd say the last 6 months, she was no longer drinking. So if that answers your question,
It does. It does. I appreciate it. When you brought up the story about, am I a bad, or when she called you a bad son or whatnot, it sounded like something coming from perhaps somebody that's drinking, right? It's extreme. It's over the top. It's obviously not true. She's hurting. I don't know if she was drinking at that time, and I don't think it matters, but I think that when we're in recovery, we have the opportunity to be around, and I'm not going to edit out your story unless you later want me to, but
No,
I mean, buying her
not at
alcohol
all.
and bringing her alcohol, I mean, these are the things we do, what we do to help the ones we love. And you were bartending in sobriety, so there's no fast and hard rules, but I needed to know, or wanted to know. I didn't need to know. about your mom
I would say now, I mean, you're kind of, when you say this out loud to me, and I think of your audience listening to this, and I say to myself, did my mom die as a person who was an alcoholic? Obviously she had years of sobriety for a while there. She was a drug and alcohol counselor. Did she choose to go out that way? As we get sober, we start to grow. Several times my mom said to me, "You are not my equal." Where is that coming from? That's coming from a place of insecurity. That's coming from a place of vulnerability, insecurity, mm-hmm. period. And so she's a flawed individual. She still is my mom. I love her, but that's a reality that, all of our lives, was my mom, I'm not going to say she's abusive, who knows, but, that was, could that be a reaction from a person who is suffering from alcoholism? Could it be? Maybe. But, my mom came from the wrong side of the tracks, and she grew up with a chip on her shoulder. Her dad was a raging alcoholic. Her mom was not there for her. I'm sure her mom was abusive. My mom worked her ass off to get where she got in this world, and she carried that insecurity with her. Part of that me wanting to be her cosmic guru was that as a son, I saw her, and I tried to talk to her, say, "Mom, look at me. This is me. See me for who I am, not who you think I am, right? Look at me." Now, as I, work the steps of my program, as I'm becoming a man, see me as a man, let me help you, when she was in this cancer, when she was going through that. And she fought that the whole way. She would not allow herself to be vulnerable. We do that as alcoholics. We will fight that and resist that desire to say, "I need help." It's like someone in a fight, in a bar fight, when someone, if you let the two guys go, they probably won't go. But as soon as someone holds the other guy back, it's on. They push forward, and it's so hard for us alcoholics to say, "I need help." How hard was it for me to walk back into, whatever that stuff is for your heart. I can't remember now. Nitroglycerin pills. My blood pressure's, I'm going to stroke. I can't stop drinking because my ego won't let me go back into the rooms. I finally I got beaten to a pulp. I beat myself to a pulp. They say that, we have to submit. I didn't submit. I was beaten. I beat the crap out of myself. And there was officer and a gentleman. I had no place else to go, and AA took me in and built me back up.
And that part where you're coming into the meeting with alcohol, having to drink, that 5 days before you started teaching, and they welcomed you. I've been kicked out of a meeting because I smelled like alcohol where I live. And that's just a beautiful thing to envision when we're broken and you want to surrender and the rooms open the doors and welcomed you in.
What else? That's a hard thing to do because I remember not too long after that, maybe about a year into my sobriety, a guy came in and he was drunk, but he wasn't violent or angry. He was just talking, and everybody in the room could see this meeting hall. It gets 150, 200 people in this meeting hall. And the guy was obviously drunk, and I remember my first reaction was like, "Get that guy out of here." And I was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." I didn't say that obviously, but I remember thinking that in the back of my mind. I go, "Who am I to think like that? I was that guy. I came in, into these rooms drunk." But that's the 12th step, if the hand, but the hand of AA, right?
Yeah.
The hand of AA is there for me. I mean, that's, you know, so.
Well, this has been deep, bro.
Well, I hope it wasn't boring. That's the only thing I hope it was.
No, but I do have one final question. I do appreciate you going there about your mom. You know, my mother, I was obsessed with my mother from the time I was born. And that never changed throughout her short life. And she always said, never, never, never talk bad about the dead. And so I certainly did not feel like that was where we went with your mom. And I appreciate you going there.
And, I totally agree about that. Don't speak poorly about the dead. And I didn't, I just spoke honestly.
Well, I appreciate it.
You know, my mom, like I said, is the I mean, I'm staring at a quilt on her bed that is a picture of all of our families on it. And I wouldn't be where I'm at if it wasn't for her.
She clearly loved you because that comes through how much you love her.
Yeah.
Final question.
Yep.
For the alcoholic out there listening, perhaps still suffering, what do you have to say?
You know, I do, I'm an English teacher, and I at the beginning of the semester, if I have a class that I feel is not up to par, I do a short writing assignment, and I ask them to write about an obstacle they've overcame or they're trying to overcome. And you would be amazed by some of the confessions some of these students have shared with me. Sexual abuse, alcoholism, drug addiction, violence, you know, jail, prisons. And when I read those papers, I might write on the side of the margins, you know, there's an easier, softer way, you know, or some kind of little AA slogan. To let them know that I'm there if they need me to be there. I feel strongly about anonymity, but I am not ashamed of what I that I'm an alcoholic. And so, for anybody that is out there that is suffering from this disease, you know, you're not alone, and there is an easier, softer way, and that is. Reach out, you know, to find those. I mean, to sound, you know, hokey about it, but it truly is for the real alcoholic that can't stop picking up. There is no other way. Pain, death, hospitals, institutions. Is where you're going to go. AA is the solution. The fellowship, throwing yourself in the middle of this program, is the answer. I will say this last thing. The 12 step is kind of written a little bit backwards for me. After working those steps, working that program in my everyday life and helping other alcoholics has given me that spiritual awakening. So doing stuff in life that's esteemable, helping people in need, gives me that spiritual connection to a higher power. So coming to that program, you are, you know, coming to AA, reaching out to somebody, for me to say to them, they're doing more for me than I'm going to do for them. But for those of you who can't pick up, welcome.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.